The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. To find out more about this talk show or other talk shows broadcasting on KUCI, log on to our website at kuci.org or check out the latest program guide.
You're listening to KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine and KUCI.org on the web. Welcome to Privacy Piracy. I'm Lloyd. I'm the show's engineer, and your host is Mari Frank. Mari's a local attorney and certified information privacy professional. She's the author of several books, including Safeguard Your Identity, From Victim to Victor, and The Complete Idiot's Guide to Recovering from Identity Theft. She's testified many times in Congress and the California legislature on privacy and identity theft issues. And you may have seen her on Dateline, 48 Hour, CNN, NBC, ABC, O'Reilly Factor, and many other shows, including her own 90-minute PBS television special, Protecting Yourself in the Information Age. To learn more about this radio show and our great guests, please visit kuci.org/privacypiracy. Hey, Mari, what's our show about today?
Well, Lloyd, today our show is about cybersecurity. And I think you remember just a couple months ago, I went to San Francisco to see the RSA conference. And there I met this wonderful man, Michael Kaiser, who is the executive director of the National Cybersecurity Alliance. And I had a great time talking with him. He's doing wonderful work for our whole society, and I thought it would be great to have him on, so he's our guest. And let me tell you a little bit about Michael Kaiser. He joined the National Cybersecurity Alliance in 2008, and as the chief executive, Michael engages diverse constituencies such as business, government, and other nonprofit organizations in NACSA's broad public education and outreach efforts to strengthen the nation's cyber infrastructure, including leadership of NACSA's premier outreach and awareness campaign, National Cybersecurity Awareness Month. And, you know, we hear all about cybersecurity and all the breaches and all the concerns about our infrastructure in this country. This is really important stuff. NACSA builds efforts through public-private partnerships that address cybersecurity issues for people like us, home users, and people who in business, K-12 and higher education, and small businesses as well. Michael serves on the Department of Commerce NTIA Online Safety Technology Working Group, and he was named one of SC Magazine's Information Security Luminaries of 2009. Prior to joining NACSA, Michael spent 25 years in the field of victim services and rights, and while holding senior positions at the National Center for Victims of Crime in Washington, D.C., and Safe Horizon in New York City. Actually, I've been a volunteer for the National Center for Victims of Crime in Washington, D.C. myself and have spoken for them. So that's a connection that we have. Michael has developed training and other programs on the use of technology in crimes such as stalking and identity theft. And he worked on programs exploring the use of technology to improve community policing. Along with his wife, Laura Fisher Kaiser, he co-authored the official eBay Guide to Buying, Selling, and Collecting Just About Anything by Simon & Schuster. And he was one of a small group of eBay University instructors, and he's personally trained more than 8,000 eBay users on expanding their eBay businesses. He's done great work, and we are just so thrilled to have him. And you can find out more about the National Cybersecurity Alliance at staysafeonline.org. Michael, it's great to talk to you again.
Oh, well, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, it was so fun to meet you, and now here we are doing what we talked about, that we were going to have this. So why don't you tell us, how did you even get into this space?
Well, you know, it's interesting. As you were reading my background, I think you'll see that there's some threads that pulled me through here. I think I've always been interested in security and safety. When you deal with victims' issues, that's a very major issue for all victims of crime. both preventing victimization as well as for people who have been victims. And as I was working in that field over time, I was always interested in technology as well. I think technology is a great enabler. It allows us to not only be more efficient and those kinds of things, but create communities and work together in ways that we never have before. And I sort of started to blend that all together as I was doing some of the work I did in the latter part of my career in victim services, which was working on issues around technology and crime, such as stalking and domestic violence, in which technology, even back in the early 2000s when high-speed web access was just becoming available to people, we were already starting to see the first iterations of people using technology, not only for good, but sometimes for bad. And as you can see, I also wrote a book on eBay, so I was very interested in how, you know, people can use the Internet, for example, selling on the Internet to improve their lives. Many stories, great stories about people who turned to eBay or to other online commerce sites and found a new passion and a new career, helped their family in ways that they couldn't do before. So I'm always really interested in the impact of technology in our lives. And when I got to the National Cybersecurity Alliance, I was kind of able to put that all together because we do education awareness, which is very much a part of what we did in the victim services work as well, and blending that with technology. So it's really been a fun ride.
Right. And it's so wonderful that, you know, we all love technology. We love all the benefits of it. But there is that worrisome part, the dark side of the Internet. So we really appreciate all that you're doing in terms of education and helping people to stay safe online. So what, in your opinion, what does the average internet user understand about what kind of information is being collected about them and why it's even being collected?
You know, I think the average person has some understanding and then a whole bunch of areas where they don't understand, right?
Right.
So, you know, I think that there's emerging understanding now around most people that when you're working in a, you know, like on a social network or you have a free email account, that comes with some exchange of information as part of the value proposition. Now, that doesn't mean that they totally understand it or that they understand necessarily exactly what's being collected about them and how it's being used. But I do think that there is certainly emerging understanding that these services, which many of which are free, also come with some exchange of information. You are going to probably see ads. If the ads are being produced well, they're going to be maybe related to things that you've been either posting about or searching about on a specific site. And so they're going to, I think there's emerging understanding of that. Beyond, you know, sort of that level of understanding, I don't think there's quite as much understanding about the general user, about when and where information is being collected about them, how that information is being collected, and where it's being disseminated. And I think that's something that consumers have to, you know, definitely get a better understanding of. I think they should be doing that more and more often, looking at things like privacy policies and thinking about, you know, what's being shared. I mean, another example of that would be in the mobile space, right?
Right.
So more and more, you know, this little device, this pocket computer, if you will, that you sometimes call your smartphone, but it's really much more powerful than a phone.
Right.
That device is transmitting information about you quite frequently, including your location, and other things that's information about you that can be collected and used. And how that device interacts with the software that you've loaded onto your phone, or apps, as we more commonly call them, is something I think that consumers are not as aware of.
Right, right. And, you know, I think especially the young people, they don't really get it that there's no free lunch, that if they download all these free apps, somehow, some way, these people who are developing these apps need to make some money. And so I think that's really a big concern as well. Although, you know, I think the older generation is starting to have a greater understanding. And I saw from you that there is a recent Pew study that says 86%, that's a high percentage, of internet users have taken steps online to remove or mask their digital footprints. So, what do you think about that? What do you think that tells us? And do you think that really, you know, that you know, that that's, that percentage is really that high?
Well, I think, you know, well, Pew is a very reputable, you know, research organization.
Right.
So I trust their numbers more than I would trust some others. I think this is actually a really good thing.
Right.
Right. I think that this tells me that people are more and more starting to actively engage in their online presence.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, at the dawn of the internet and the dawn of, you know, the sharing web 2.0, where, you know, people really became the content providers as opposed to just the content receivers, which was the first iteration of the web, right? You
yeah.
basically looked at stagnant content. You weren't engaging in that content and responding or actually creating content, right? You know, people didn't really think a lot about the things they were posting or the things that they were writing and how that might impact them over the long term, right?
Right.
I think there's a growing understanding, and certainly I think there's actually a growing understanding with young people as well, very much so actually, that, you know, information online has an extremely long shelf life.
Mm-hmm.
And that managing your reputation in the digital age is an active engagement you must participate in, that no one's going to manage your reputation for you, and that you know, we like to say stop, think, connect, right? You know, that you really need to stop and make sure and think about the consequences of what you're about to post, and, you know, understand the potential good and harm to it. I think, though, this is an important point, that there's both good things and bad things to post, right? And I think people are looking at that, too, is how can I improve my reputation?
And I think it's a little bit scary because, you know, you're not in charge of what someone else puts up about you, right? Or what pictures they put up about you. I mean, you really don't have control over what other people are saying about you. So, you know, I remember reading Dan Solove's book, The Future of Reputation on the Internet. It's a tough place as well. You can be careful about what you post on all the different websites and the social media, but there is some things that are beyond your control, and it's tough to get that stuff off, right?
Yeah, you know, I think that's a great point. I think, you know, part of what hasn't emerged yet, and I think this is something we think about a lot, are what are the social norms around sharing in this society, and what's it going to be going forward?
Mm-hmm.
Because you do have this very powerful tool, and there is, you know, And it's not all, I mean, you can have very bad cases, right? So, you know, from my previous life, you know, looking at things like stalking where people, you know, put up harassing websites about the person that they're stalking and, you know, post horrible information about them and lies and rumors and all those kinds of things, you
right.
know, and so you can have that, you can have that bad thing. But you can also have people post, well-intentioned people posting things that other people don't want posted, right?
Right.
And that may reveal information about them that they don't want revealed. And that's, you know, a more around a social norming of how we think about, and really how we think about the information that people entrust to us. You know, a simple example would be this. You know, in the days of yore, so to speak, right, you go to the family reunion and, you know, everybody has their camera and you take pictures and,
right.
you know, and you know, they come home, they get developed, you know, you look at them, you put them in a folder, and, like, there's the family reunion, right?
Right?
And now, you know, people are taking those pictures and they're posting them on their, you know, social networks, or they're, you know, tweeting them out or doing whatever they're doing. And they're not always thinking about, you know, would Uncle Louie really want his picture out there?
Right.
Or am I telling too much about my family that somebody might be able to use against me or collect this information a different way when I say, you know, here's the Smith family and, you know, here we are at the family homestead, you know, that my uncle still owns in Ohio. I mean, you know, the kinds of stuff that, you know, people can cobble together to create an identity about you or use against you in some way.
Right.
And it's well-intentioned. It's not, you know, it's just we have to think about these things in the digital age.
I know. I just put up recently a bunch of pictures from this Orange County Mediation Conference that I was in charge of, and I was really careful to only put up really good pictures of some of these people that were there that were presenting, because I didn't want them to be mad at me that I was putting up something. But then somebody put up a picture of me that I really didn't like. You know what I'm saying? So I didn't look that good. I had my mouth open or something like that. So, you know, I could, even something as, you know, innocent as that, you know, we would put up what we want to put up. We don't want to put up something where our mouth is half open. So,
yeah,
you're right. I mean, it's just a challenge for us.
Yeah, and that really comes down to being thoughtful, right?
Yes.
I mean, look, not everybody's a great photographer, so sometimes that can happen. But, you know, it's about being thoughtful when you think about a picture as somebody entrusting a piece of personal information to you,
right,
about them. And that's really how you have to envision that picture. And we are entrusted with so much more personal information about people than we have had in the past in our daily lives. And
right.
We're sitting on that information in many different venues, but we have to really be thoughtful and respectful of that.
Yes, and I think you're right. We have to establish the norms. And, you know, we see these poor kids who go through this, the online bullying and all these horrible things that they're putting up. And I hear a lot about it because I get calls about these kinds of things or online identity theft. Somebody will take a head of their head and put it on another body or make it look like they're a prostitute or something. So, I mean, this is the kind of stuff that we really have to establish kind of norms and something to help the dark side, don't we?
Yeah, we do. I mean, I think that's part of, I think, what happens with every cycle of new technology that comes online. I mean, if you think back, you know, even farther, think about to when cars got introduced, right? I mean, how did we come up with things like, you know, the right of way or, these things that become part of the way we use the technology and how we, we probably didn't originally even have things like stop signs or speed limits or, you know, those kinds of things. And I think, you know, technology, when it gets introduced, can be disruptive to the social fabric. And in a good way and a bad way. This is not a negative comment about technology, but we don't always catch up so quickly about how to integrate it in a way, successfully integrate it in a way that, you know, people are comfortable with. And that's a challenge. That's a privacy challenge, I think, for people in this day and age.
And we were talking, and there was a lot of talk at the RSA conference where you and I were, a lot of talk about privacy and security. So let's talk a little bit about the relationship between privacy and security. They're different, but they really go as partners, don't they?
Yeah, they're really deeply intertwined. I really think of them as almost being, you know, in a symbiotic relationship, that they both support each other. I think we have a couple of different issues going on in security and privacy. There have been disciplines that have emerged, right, in both privacy and security that have not always worked as closely together as they should. At the simplest level, of course, you can't have privacy if you can't secure the personal information that you have about people.
Right.
So there's a security risk to the loss of information that leads to a privacy violation. And so that's a very core way that they're connected and a way that we have to, you know, people have to think about it. We always think about, you know, if you collect it, you got to protect it, right?
Right.
And that's a security. On the same side, that personal information, right, the exposure of personal information can create security problems in different kinds of venues as well. So, whether it's the credentials of somebody that allows them to be them within a network that might cause a security problem. So there's a lot of different ways they're intertwined. I'm hopeful that we'll see more real discussion about how privacy and security can work together and how we don't, there are definitely disciplines and there's a lot of law around privacy and there's a lot of technology around security, but they are, they need to work hand in hand, I think, to really both protect people and protect people's personal information. It's really important that we work together.
Yes, and I think one of the things that companies need to think about, whether they're a small company or a large company, is what are they collecting? How much are they collecting? And do they really need to collect all that they're collecting? Because the more that they collect, the more they have to secure. So if they are not collecting a lot of personally identifiable information and sensitive data, then, you know, the security breach issues are less of a concern. So not only do they, as you know, as the security people, have to secure the data and make it private and confidential, but if they don't need to collect it, they shouldn't even be collecting it because it just exposes them to more you know, liability as well. So that's another side of it is like, you know, when you're thinking about as a person, you know, an individual or as a company, you know, you need to think about what am I collecting or what am I providing, which kind of leads to the question is what, you know, what do you tell consumers about how to protect their privacy?
Well, I think that consumers, you know, need to do a few different things. I mean, the classic advice, of course, is, you know, read the privacy policy or the terms and services of the services you're going to use. And I think that that's a pretty big burden for consumers. They shouldn't read them. I'm not saying they shouldn't read them, but it's a big burden. They're long, they're cumbersome, they're illegal, and they don't always actually clearly tell you exactly what's going on, right? I mean, to the average person.
And they change, and they can change them, too. I mean, you read them, and then you know, you don't go, you figure, okay, well, I read this privacy policy, and then you don't know that they've just changed it five more times since the last time you read it. So that's another challenge.
Yeah, I think the good news is that people are starting to get that they need to be clearer about this, that consumers are getting smarter, that consumers are concerned about this issue. And, you know, you start to see now, you know, sometimes, you know, permission being asked at certain kinds of ways that, you know, this application is going to use your location. Is that okay with you? And if you, you know, if you say no, maybe you can't use the application, but at least you made a decision, right?
Right.
I'm not going to allow my location to be used for this, you know, app. So at least you know that that was a possibility if it's okay with you. I mean, there are some apps for which location is absolutely, you know, a necessary function. I mean, if you have a map and it's going to tell you to get from where you are to where you want to go,
right,
you know, sharing your location might be important. I mean, there was a recent case, I believe, with a flashlight app that was free where that was collecting location about consumers. There was no, as you're saying, there was no connection between the functionality of that piece of software and location collection. And that's the thing that I think consumers need to always pay attention to. And I think not only consumers, but business owners. You know, one of the things I think that happens for the businesses is it's so easy to collect this information. It's like, well, why not collect it? Because maybe we could use it later.
Right.
You know, and it's like, no, you know, only collect what you really, really, really need. And I think consumers know this too. I mean, we have some data from some earlier studies we did a couple years ago around people dropping off of shopping sites. And some people do drop off of shopping carts because they think the vendor's collecting more information than they need to complete the transaction. So consumers are smart. You know, they're like, why would you need all this information? I'm just buying a book.
Right.
You know,
right.
Yeah, sure, you need my home address because I expect to get the book.
Right.
But, you know, beyond that, what do you really need?
Exactly.
And so,
yeah, so what do you think, at least for consumers, what do you think is the future of privacy for average people?
So I think the future of privacy for average people is going to be much more active engagement in their digital lives. There's going to have to be more thought given to information that they share, both about themselves and others. I think there's going to have to be more active engagement around the kinds of services they use and the understanding of not only the explicit information that's being collected, but, you know, more savvy about how information may be cobbled together about you from different places at any given time. And, you know, we're going to have to live in a sort of digital privacy age where people are paying attention to that from a very, very young age.
Yeah.
From the first time they get online.
Yeah, little, you know, kids know how to deal with it. I mean, it's amazing when I see sometimes these little 3- and 4-year-olds using their mom or dad's iPhone or iPad, right?
Right.
It's amazing.
Well, at least if they're using mom and dad's iPhone.
Yes, yeah, but rather than their own.
You know, there may be some question about, like, you know, why did they keep going to that, you know, that device, you know, that you know, that site for 8-year-olds, but you know, but in some level they're, you know, at least associating that activity with their parent. But they're probably exposing, you know, the fact that there's a child in this household, right?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe not their personal information, maybe not, you know, exactly when they were born. Maybe there's some guess if it's a boy or a girl based on what, you know, game they like or what game they're using, and that may, you know, could be turned into, you know, maybe a marketing ploy comes to you, you know, to buy a new game, right? So
yes.
Certainly that connection is there. And I think those are the more tenuous things that it's very difficult for people to get their arms around at some level, right?
Yeah.
But at least the young person's not necessarily exposing, deep personal information about themselves.
Right. So we're talking with Michael Kaiser, who's the executive director of the National Cybersecurity Alliance. And, Michael, we not only are on the campus here at the University of California, but we also have a lot of businesses drive by, and we have our own little miniature Silicon Valley in Aliso Viejo, where we have a lot of startups and stuff, and we have lots of businesses that drive by, and we have a big business school here. So, what would you say how businesses are responding to consumer privacy concerns?
Well, I think we see a couple of things going on in this space. One, we see some businesses that are growing up with privacy as a competitive advantage, right?
Yes.
So we're seeing some new website tools. We're seeing some email encryption tools that are becoming more popular and things like that. So people are looking at privacy actually as a growth opportunity in some ways, right? So I think, that's sort of interesting because that allows consumers to, actively engage in privacy, to take a more proactive role for themselves when they see, when that's appropriate to their lives. I'm hoping that we'll see more businesses do a little bit more of what we were talking about earlier, which is really slimming down what they collect about people unless it's absolutely necessary. I think we have emerged in this digital age with some businesses that use personal information as a business model. And I think that's something that needs to be more in the public debate, right? I don't think there's anything wrong with that per se, at face value. But I think that that's something that's not as fully understood by everyone. And also, by the way, this is not just for consumers, but also what's the burden on someone who wants to create a business that uses that information? Right? What's the right way to do that? Back to that norm piece. How is that information used that both ways that's expected, right? You collect my address and you send me something that I purchased for you. That's a pretty expected use of data. And what is the unexpected use of data that consumers may not have thought of? And how do you communicate that to people?
Yes. We have just about 2 minutes left, and I know that your website, staysafeonline.org, has wonderful education. And just could you talk a little bit about what your website has and what role education has, in making the internet more safe and secure?
Yeah, well, education is critical, and we believe education from trusted source, whether that's a business, a friend, a family member, or nonprofit or other institution that you trust that comes from that, is the most trusted source of information about and get people change their behavior. Our website has information on all kinds of security and privacy issues that people can cut and paste and use, tip sheets. But it also has our portals for Data Privacy Day, which allow people to create their own campaigns and participate in Data Privacy Day, which is January 28th every year, and also National Cybersecurity Awareness Month in October. In addition, it has information for businesses around cybersecurity and how to make their businesses more cybersecure.
Well, you are terrific, and I'm so glad that we got to meet at RSA and have this, and we will stay in touch. And just give your website once again, and then it'll be time for us to go.
Well, the website is staysafeonline.org, and let me just say this, really pleased to be with you today, and great conversation.
And thanks. We will talk again soon. You take care, and you stay safe, Mike, okay?
Okay, thank you.
Alrighty, bye-bye. You've been listening to KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine and KUCI.org. I'm Mari Frank. Join us every Monday morning at 8 a.m. and visit our website at KUCI.org/privacypiracy. Thanks.
Stay private.
The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents.